"This hasn't been the best weekend of my life, I'm afraid," she said. "But it seems that I owe you a great deal of thanks, Mr. Reacher. My husband tells me you saved his life in prison." She said it with a lot of ice in her voice. Not aimed at me, aimed at whatever circumstance it was, forcing her to use the words husband and prison in the same sentence. "No problem," I said. "Where is he?"
"Taking care of some business," Charlie said. "I expect him back later."
I nodded. That had been Hubble's plan. He'd said he would spin her some kind of a yarn and then try to settle things down. I wondered if Charlie wanted to talk about it, but the children were standing silently next to her, and I could see she wouldn't talk in front of them. So I grinned at them. I hoped they would get all shy and run off somewhere like children usually do with me, but they just grinned back.
"This is Ben," Charlie said, "and this is Lucy."
They were nice-looking kids. The girl still had that little girl chubbiness, no front teeth, fine sandy hair and pigtails. The boy wasn't much bigger than his little sister. He had a slight frame and a serious face, not a rowdy hooligan like some boys are. They were a nice pair of kids, polite and quiet. They both shook hands with me and then stepped back to their mother's side. I looked at the three of them, and I could just about see the terrible cloud hanging there over them. If Hubble didn't take care, he could get them all as dead as he'd gotten my brother.
"Will you come in for some iced tea?"
Charlie asked us. She stood there, her head cocked like she was waiting for an answer. She was maybe 30, similar age to Roscoe, but she had a rich woman's ways. 150 years ago, she'd have been the mistress of a big plantation. "Okay," I said. "Thanks." The kids ran off to play somewhere, and Charlie ushered us in through the front door. I didn't really want to drink any iced tea, but I did want to stick around in case Hubble got back. I wanted to catch him on my own for 5 minutes. I wanted to ask him some pretty urgent questions before Finley started in with the Miranda warnings. It was a fabulous house. Huge, beautifully furnished, light and fresh, cool creams and sunny yellows, flowers. Charlie led us through to the garden room we'd seen from the outside. It was like something from a magazine. Roscoe went off with her to help fix the tea, left me alone in the room. It made me uneasy. I wasn't accustomed to houses. 36 years old, and I'd never lived in a house. Lots of service accommodations and a terrible bare dormitory on the Hudson when I was up at the Point. That's where I'd lived. I sat down like an ugly alien on a flowered cushion on a cane sofa and waited. Uneasy, numb, in that dead zone between action and reaction. The two women came back with the tea. Charlie was carrying a silver tray. She was a handsome woman, but she was nothing next to Roscoe. Roscoe had a spark in her eyes so electric it made Charlie just about invisible. Then something happened. Roscoe sat down next to me on the cane sofa. As she sat, she pushed my leg to one side. It was a casual thing, but it was very intimate and familiar. A numbed nerve end suddenly clicked in and screamed at me, "She likes you too. She likes you too." It was the way she touched my leg. I went back and looked at things in that new light. Her manner as she took the fingerprints and the photographs, bringing me the coffee, her smile and her wink, her laugh. Working Friday night and Saturday so she could get me out of Warburton, driving all the way over there to pick me up, holding my hand after I'd seen my brother's broken body, giving me a ride over here. She liked me, too. All of a sudden, I was glad I had jumped off that damn bus, glad I made that crazy last-minute decision. I suddenly relaxed, felt better. The tiny voice in my head quieted down. Right then, there was nothing for me to do. I'd speak to Hubble when I saw him. Until then, I would sit on a sofa with a good-looking, friendly, dark-haired woman in a soft cotton shirt. The trouble would start soon enough. It always does.
Right then, there was nothing for me to do. I'd speak to Hubble when I saw him. Until then, I would sit on a sofa with a good-looking, friendly, dark-haired woman in a soft cotton shirt. The trouble would start soon enough. It always does. Charlie Hubble sat down opposite us and started pouring the iced tea from the pitcher. The smell of lemon and spices drifted over. She caught my eye and smiled, the same strained smile she'd used before.
Normally, at this point, I'd ask you how you were enjoying your visit with us here in Margrave, she said, looking at me, strained, smiling.
I couldn't think of a reply to that. I just shrugged. It was clear Charlie didn't know anything. She thought her husband had been arrested because of some kind of a mistake, not because he was grabbed up in some kind of trouble which had just got two people murdered, one of which was the brother of the stranger she was busy smiling at. Roscoe rescued the conversation, and the two of them started passing the time of day. I just sat there and drank the tea and waited for Hubble. He didn't show up. Then the conversation died, and we had to get out of there. Charlie was fidgeting like she had things to do. Roscoe put her hand on my arm. Her touch burned me like electricity.
Let's go, she said. I'll give you a ride back to town.
I felt bad I wasn't staying to wait for Hubble. It made me feel disloyal to Joe. But I just wanted to be on my own with Roscoe. I was burning up with it. Maybe some kind of repressed grief was intensifying it. I wanted to leave Joe's problems until tomorrow. I told myself I had no choice anyway. Hubble hadn't shown up. Nothing else I could do. So we got back in the Chevy together and nosed down the winding driveway. Cruised down Beckman. The buildings thickened up at the bottom of the mile. We jinked around the church. The little village green with the statue of old Caspar Teal was ahead.
Reacher, Roscoe said. You'll be around for a while, right? Until we get this thing about your brother straightened out?
I guess I will, I said.
Where are you going to stay?
She asked. I don't know, I said. She pulled over to the curb near the lawn, nudged the selector into park. She had a tender look on her face.
I want you to come home with me, she said.
I felt like I was out of my mind, but I was burning up with it, so I pulled her to me, and we kissed. That fabulous first kiss. The new and unfamiliar mouth, and hair, and taste, and smell. She kissed hard and long and held on tight. We came up for air a couple of times before she took off again for her place. She blasted a quarter mile down the street, which opened up opposite Beckman Drive. I saw a blur of greenery in the sun as she swooped into her driveway. The tires chirped as she stopped. We more or less tumbled out and ran to the door. She used her key and we went in. The door swung shut and before it clicked, she was back in my arms. We kissed and stumbled through to her living room. She was a foot shorter than me and her feet were off the ground. We tore each other's clothes off like they were on fire. She was gorgeous. Firm and strong and a shape like a dream, skin like silk. She pulled me to the floor through bars of hot sunlight from the window. It was frantic. We were rolling, and nothing could have stopped us. It was like the end of the world. We shuddered to a stop and lay gasping. We were bathed in sweat, totally spent. We lay there, clasped and caressing. Then she got off me and pulled me up. We kissed again as we staggered through to her bedroom. She pulled back the covers on the bed and we collapsed in, held each other, and fell into a deep afterglow stupor. I was wrecked. I felt like all my bones and sinews were rubber. I lay in the unfamiliar bed and drifted away to a place far beyond relaxation. I was floating. Roscoe's warm heft was snuggled beside me. I was breathing through her hair. Our hands were lazily caressing unfamiliar contours. She asked me if I wanted to go find a motel or to stay there with her. I laughed and told her the only way to get rid of me now would be to go fetch a shotgun from the station house and chase me away. I told her even that might not work. She giggled and pressed even closer.
I wouldn't fetch a shotgun, she whispered. I'd fetch some handcuffs. I'd chain you to the bed and keep you here forever.
We dozed through the afternoon. I called the Hubble place at 7 in the evening. He still wasn't back. I left Roscoe's number with Charlie and told her to have Hubble call me as soon as he got in. Then we drifted on through the rest of the evening. Fell fast asleep at midnight. Hubble never called. Monday morning, I was vaguely aware of Roscoe getting up for work. I heard the shower, and I know she kissed me tenderly, and then the house was hot and quiet and still. I slept on until after 9. The phone didn't ring. I was okay. I needed some quiet thinking time. I had decisions to make. I stretched out in Roscoe's warm bed and started answering the question the tiny voice in my head was asking me again. What was I going to do about Joe? My answer came very easily. I knew it would. I knew it had been waiting there since I first stood next to Joe's broken body in the morgue. It was a very simple answer. I was going to stand up for him. I was going to finish his business, whatever it was, whatever it took. I didn't foresee any major difficulties. Hubble was the only link I had, but Hubble was the only link I needed. He would cooperate. He'd depended on Joe to help him out. Now he'd depend on me. He'd give me what I needed. His masters were vulnerable for a week. What had he said? A window of exposure wide open until Sunday? I'd use it to tear them apart. My mind was made up. I couldn't do it any other way. I couldn't leave it to Finley. Finley wouldn't understand all those years of history. Finley wouldn't sanction the sort of punishments that were going to be necessary. Finley couldn't understand the simple truth I'd learned at the age of 4. You don't mess with my brother. So this was my business. It was between me and Joe. It was duty. I lay there in Roscoe's warm bed and scoped it out. It was going to be a simple process, about as simple as you could get. Getting hold of Hubble wasn't going to be difficult. I knew where he lived. I knew his phone number. I stretched and smiled and filled with restless energy. Got out of bed and found coffee. There was a note propped against the pot. The note said, "Early lunch at Eno's, 11 o'clock. Leave Hubble to Finley, okay?" The note was signed with lots of kisses and a little drawing of a pair of handcuffs. I read it and smiled at the drawing. But I wasn't going to leave Hubble to Finley. No way. Hubble was my business. So I looked up the number again and called Beckman Drive. There was nobody home. I poured a big mug of coffee and wandered through to the living room. The sun was blinding outside. It was another hot day. I walked through the house. It was a small place. A living room, an eat-in kitchen, 2 bedrooms, 2.5 baths. Very new, very clean. Decorated in a cool, simple way. What I would expect from Roscoe. A cool, simple style. Some nice Navajo art, some bold rugs, white walls. She must have been to New Mexico and liked it. It was still and quiet. She had a stereo, a few records and tapes, more sweet and melodic than the howl and buzz that I call music. I got more coffee from her kitchen, went out back. There was a small yard out there, a neat, coarse lawn, and some recent evergreen planting. Shredded bark to smother weeds and rough timber edging against the planted areas. I stood in the sun and sipped the coffee. Then I ducked back inside and tried Hubble's number again. No reply. I showered and dressed. Roscoe had a small shower stall, the head set low, feminine soaps in the dish. I found a towel in a closet and a comb on a vanity. No razor. I put my clothes on and rinsed out the coffee mug. Tried Hubble's number again from the kitchen phone. I let it ring for a long time. Nobody home. I figured I'd get a ride up there from Roscoe after lunch. This thing wasn't going to wait forever. I relocked the back door and went out the front. It was about 10:30. A mile and a quarter up to Eno's place. A gentle half-hour stroll in the sun. It was already very hot, well into the 80s. Glorious fall weather in the south.
I walked the quarter mile to Main Street up a gently winding rise. Everything was beautifully manicured. There were towering magnolia trees everywhere and late blossom in the shrubs. I turned at the coffee shop and strolled up Main Street. The sidewalks outside the stores had been swept. I could see crews of gardeners in the little park areas. They were setting up sprinklers and barrowing stuff out of smart green trucks marked Kleiner Foundation in gold. A couple of guys were painting the picket fence. I waved in at the two old barbers in their shop. They were leaning up inside their doorway like they were waiting for custom. They waved back, and I strolled on. Eno's came into sight. The polished aluminum siding gleamed in the sun. Roscoe's Chevrolet was in the lot. Standing next to it on the gravel was the black pickup I'd seen the day before, outside the coffee shop. I reached the diner and pushed in through the door. I had been prodded out through it on Friday with Stevenson's shotgun pointed at my gut. I had been in handcuffs. I wondered if the diner people would remember me. I figured they probably would. Margrave was a very quiet place, not a whole lot of strangers passing through.